Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, to bring you our opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events. Today is Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. Wendy Wilson will be here in a few moments after the market report. Good afternoon, Al.
Hello, Melody.
Today's my favorite day of the year, winter solstice. So, shortest day of the year, but every day thereafter, they get just a little bit longer. So, one of my favorite days of the year. So, happy winter to you.
Happy winter solstice.
Happy
to all
winter
these people
solstice.
Out there that are...
And it happens everywhere. I don't know if there's spring solstice, if that happens everywhere, but the winter solstice, it actually happens every place on Earth, everywhere on Earth. So, at one single moment. So, there you go. Let's go to the prices today. We have gold, a little pressure on gold, down $1.20. In the aftermarket, New York spot at 1131.90. You have silver down 15 cents at 1602. Platinum is down 8, 918. And palladium is down 11 at $659. USDX today, down 0.30 at 103. Crude oil is down 77 at 52.53. And the paper markets today, we have the Dow, a little bit of pressure, down 32 points, 19,942. The NASDAQ down 12 at 5,471. The S&P down 5, 2,265. Maybe the Dow 20,000 will be just as elusive as the gold 2000 was. So we'll see about that. But hey, it's a paper market. They can trade it. And I'll guarantee you they'll give it to the as a Merry Christmas present. We'll see. But the euro is 104 today. What's the 10-year doing today? 2.55. A little pressure on that, down 0.02. And a lot of things are going on. We'll be here to talk about it after the first break of the program. Because first, we have Wendy Wilson joining us from Apothecary Herbs. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody, and hello, Al.
Hello, Wendy.
I thought we'd talk about the sugarholic season that we are embarked on here. I've talked about how sugar is kind of the core of the cold and flu season before, but I thought we'd get a little bit more detail, because a lot of people don't associate the holiday sweets and with the uptick in illness during the fall and winter months, cold and flu. So we should be sensitive to what we're putting into our body, because we can identify these culprits that put us at a higher risk of getting sick. So does anybody know, aside from the sweetness of sugar, why do we like to eat sugar? Why does it prompt us to eat more of it? Anybody got an idea?
Probably it's addictive, but I'm not sure if that's accurate. But
it's got a couple of addictions, yes. The food industry actually has learned how its addictions, and that's why it puts a lot of sugar onto their products, because they know consumers will eat more of their product, especially if it contains high fructose corn syrup. But we also tend to eat more sugar when we're under certain circumstances, like if we're stressed or we're bored or we're anxious or lonely, if we're in a pain, and also, again, if we have a food addiction, either we're recovering from it or maybe it's a substance abuse issue and we're substituting for it. So if we are aware of our sweet tooth triggers, we can eliminate a lot of the sugar we're consuming, because people don't realize that the foods they're eating that contain being laced with sugar, it can add 66 to 150 pounds of annual sugar consumption to their diet. So if we're not reading product labels, we can easily eat about 20 teaspoons, which is almost 3 ounces of sugar per day. Now, according to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, that's enough to suppress your immune system for several hours. So according to sugarscience.com, one soda exceeds the daily sugar limit for adults. So when we are in physical or emotional pain, we're going to gravitate to foods that have more sugar. And sugar influences the pain-killing endorphins, which mimic a morphine chemical reaction. So you can get the same response, though, if you eat something hot and spicy or if you do aerobic exercise. So if you want to skip the sugar, try substituting one of those.
Give up sugar in order to do exercise?
Well, I mean, it gives
you... What kind of a medical recommendation is that?
Well, you get the same morphine chemical reaction.
No, I get what you're saying. It's just one of those things in this culture.
I know.
I don't think I'll hear that from
Anybody, okay. Yeah. Well, Loma Linda University did a study back in 1973, and they said eating 100 grams of sugar, that's almost 3.5 ounces, which would be equivalent to 4 drinks that have sugar in it, whether it's iced tea, soda, or alcoholic beverages. That beverage or that amount of sugar, 3.5 ounces, will suppress immune system white blood killer T cells by a minimum of 40%, and this cripples the immune system, they say, for about 5 to 8 hours. So, and this is why with all the sugar you have around the holidays and all the alcohol consumption, this is why people have, you know, suppressed immune systems and they pick up a lot of rhinoviruses and flu bugs.
Which we attribute to the cold weather.
I know. Well, you know,
and is that just an accident? Is that a function of our ignorance, or have we been conditioned to believe that in order to support the sugar industry?
Well, actually, a lot of viruses don't do so well in cold weather. If they're out there without a host keeping them warm, they die. So we're a kind of association the cold weather with being indoor more, where we're transmitting more pathogens amongst ourselves. But a report that was released in November of this year, 2016, by the Cancer Research of the UK, they stated that preteens and teenagers ages 11 to 18 consume too much sugar. And they reported that they're getting 3 times the limit of sugar through their soft drinks alone. And the National Diet and Nutritional Survey of the UK reported that children 4 to 10 years of age, get this, they consume the equivalent of 1/2 a bathtub full of sugar every year. And as that's a visual, isn't it?
You know what that reminds me of? That scene in Al Pacino. I don't remember that he's playing a mobster. I can't remember the name of the movie where he's got his face in a pile of cocaine on his desk.
Yeah.
You have little 4-year-old kids with their face in a pile of sugar on whatever passes for the desks right now. It's hard to believe.
Well, you know, governments actually look at the sugar craze as a way to leverage attacks on sugar-saturated products, because health experts and the governments know that sugar consumption is pretty much established. It creates an addiction, and therefore consumers will pay the tax. So it's just another way to make money.
Well, you know, there was a book I can remember reading. It was called The Sugar Blues.
Yeah.
And goes all the way back into the 60s. Mm-hmm. This is 60 years ago. 50 years ago, anyway. And it identified sugar and characterized it as a drug. If it was coming on the market right now, it would be right up there with cocaine and heroin and the rest of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of been grandfathered, huh?
Yeah.
Well, sugarscience.com tells us that we eat too much sugar. It's going to affect, of course, your pancreas and releases insulin. And insulin levels, if they get too high in the bloodstream, the body starts to store fat. And this actually affects a hormone called leptin. Now, this hormone's important because it's involved in regulating your appetite. So if you get too much sugar, it means that you are at a high risk of overeating. And if you're consuming a high fructose corn syrup in a lot of your foods, it creates what is called a leptin resistance, in which the brain no longer reacts to the appetite regulation and stops you from eating. And this is why we have obesity.
Which apparently, I just saw a report, they attribute obesity to the recent decline in longevity here in this country.
Well, no, it's high fructose corn syrup and sugar. Well, science knows this. The governments know this. The CDC knows. They already know this. Now, aside from giving your system a temporary lift, Al and Melody, and, of course, suppressing your immune system, what else is happening when we eat sugar? Any idea?
No, I can't. I don't know what you're going to point to.
Well, sugar sabotages your body's ability to use vitamin C. So the the immune system uses vitamin C, and sugar blocks the white blood cells from using it. Now, back in the 70s, you'll remember we got a bunch of reports in the social media, the media of the time, how important vitamin C was to help the immune system to reduce the likelihood that you would get colds and flus. But what we weren't told is that sugar can mimic the structure of vitamin C and fools the immune system and then suppresses it. I know. So, you know, it's muscling out the vitamin C when you have a lot of sugar. And what do people do for the cold and flu season? They get zinc and vitamin C going, right? And they're totally wasting their money if they're eating a lot of sugar. So when we eat refined sugar, it's kind of a stripped-down product. There's no minerals left. There's no nutrients left. And the body has a hard time metabolizing that. So what the body has to do in order to metabolize sugar, because it's a devitalized food, it has to take from your nutritional stores in order to deal with it. But if you eat natural sugars that you get in carrots, grapes, apples, oranges, etc., that has nutrients and water and fiber. But your processed sugar pretty harsh on the system, and the body attempts to flush it out as quickly as possible through the kidneys. Now, processed sugars, according to science, is almost like, if you eat a lot of processed sugar, it's almost like smoking. It'll speed up your aging process. Think about it.
You're not making my Christmas any more merry right
I'm
now.
So
you understand
sorry.
That?
No candy.
I'm gonna have to give
you.
Up on the pies and the cakes and oh my gosh, fruitcakes. We can't have a fruitcake then anymore.
Well, here's some good news. A lot of people say, well, what about, you know, honey? Can we use honey? Actually, honey is a food. It's not a processed, stripped down product. Of course, you get your sugar from sugarcane and beets, but it's highly processed, and of course, honey comes from bees. So, and people who use honey, it's a sweeter tasting item, so you use less of it to get the amount of sweet you need, so you can actually use less calories. And also, when you look at the comparison of honey and sugar side by side, of course, honey's got fructose and glucose, and sugar is sucrose. Their sugar is about the same as far as the sucrose level, but your honey will have the following nutrition that sugar does not have. It's going to have protein, calcium, iron. It's going to have vitamin C, sodium, carbohydrates, vitamin B2, which is your riboflavin, your potassium, niacin, vitamin B5, your pantothenic acid, your vitamin B6, folic acid, which is vitamin B9, magnesium, phosphorus, and zinc. That's what your honey has, and sugar has none of that.
Well, then sign me up for some honey.
That's right.
And you have to have some Greek, what is it, baklava or whatever? Is that made with honey?
Well, you mentioned that book, Sugar Rush, and it's the...
Sugar Blues.
Okay, well, there's a book called Sugar Rush. It's by Peter Singer. He's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. And he says that we're genetically programmed to like sweet things. And he also states when people become more affluent, they consume more sugar.
I can tell you that I have consumed quite a lot of sugar in the past. But I started taking ginger, just powdered ginger. I was taking raw ginger for a while, and turned out powdered was just as good. I take about a tablespoon of ginger twice a day. I have completely lost my appetite for sugar. And I used to go through a lot of ice cream and nurse, that sort of thing. It was there. I go in the grocery store right now, and it practically gives me chills to look. I look at ice cream, or I look at cakes, and it's like I have an aversion to it, and it's a function of, I know what it's a function of taking the ginger, and whether that would work for other people, I don't know, but it has absolutely just almost all but eradicated my appetite for sugar.
Yeah, Golden Seal is another one. It actually would tamp down your appetite for that, and also Celtic Sea Salt. The minerals in the salt help get rid of your sweet tooth. So you got a couple of natural things going that can help you be resistant this holiday season. You know, I mean, just, you know, moderation is the advice here. And there's a lot of beta carotene in your oranges. Your yellow pigment foods are rich in vitamin C and A, so you can kind of beef up the immune system that way. Also, your dark green chlorophyll-rich vegetables have a lot of beta carotene and vitamin E, and that helps defend your body from rhinoviruses and flu bugs. So, you know, I guess instead of a flu shot, go eat broccoli, you know? So you'll do much better. And also, you got your immune-boosting herbs like your echinacea, which comes already packed full of vitamin C and zinc. It's already in the root. I like to use formulas with the fresh echinacea root because it has the most power. If you get dried root formulas, they're still strong, but not as strong as if you got a fresh root formula. So those are like the cream of the crop. Also, astragalus root is very good. Also, heightening immune system, and you can use that more often than you do echinacea. And you can layer. You can add, for synergistic effect, a lot of herbs together for more power, like garlic and astragalus root and your echinacea. You can add them all together. And that just will power you through and helps the body. You add some ginseng, and you can get rid of the pathogens faster. That's what ginseng does. It dumps those infectious pathogens out of the system really fast. So that's why ginseng's important. So you got tools, you got dietary changes you can, you know, enforce, and you can pretty much sidestep a lot of the cold and flu this year. You really can.
I understand. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not just sidestepping colds and flu. It's my understanding that sugar is a strong contributor to cancer. Is that true or false? Am I mistaken?
No, you are absolutely right. That there have been some studies where, you know, they've said that people that, you know, consume more sugar are going to be, you know, at more of a high risk of getting cancer. Absolutely right. It also messes with the glandular system and the pulmonary system. So if you get too much sugar, that area of immunity is weaker. So, and that makes sense because rhinoviruses and flu bugs do affect glands and pulmonary.
Well, it's all very fascinating, and I mean, it's not, everybody knows we should stay away from sugar, but it's hard to resist, and we all think, well, what'll it hurt if I have just one or two slices of cake and maybe another slice of pie, and it adds up, though, and
well,
the consumption
does.
Is enormous.
Well, it does, and let's say you have a half a can of soda with your adult beverage. You know, you're having a mixed drink, and it's a party. It's time to celebrate. It's Christmas.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so, you know, one soda is your whole. It's over the top for adults dosing on sugar. So, you're not going to just have one drink. You probably have two, and then you're going to have, you know, like you said, your things that will convert to sugar as well. Your carbohydrates at your dinner, and then your dessert. So. You know, maybe some chocolates that are laying around too, and candy canes on the tree. So it's easy to over-D on the sugar. So it's sugar-holic season is what I call it, because that's what it is.
Let me ask you one question. We've got about a minute left. Mm. One question before you go. Why is it that we have an appetite for sugar at the end of a meal? You finish your meal and you find yourself, you want... We typically have our dessert then. But you want some sugar to wash it to back up the food you've just had. Do you have any idea why that is?
It depends on what you had for your entree meal. Some foods can make you crave more sugars depending on your blood sugar levels. So if you're not wanting to crave any sugar or not a lot of it after a meal, take a pinch of your Celtic sea salt and put it under your tongue, and that way you will get rid of that craving for the sweet. Also, another tip that a lot of people use is they'll use the gentian root a half hour before they eat a meal, and that prevents them from overeating, and it helps the brain listen to that leptin hormone so you don't overeat. So you probably could skip dessert then, you know?
All right, save some money besides. Give us some contact information, Wendy.
Absolutely. We have your immune-boosting formulas at thepowerherbs.com, or you can call us toll-free at 866-229-3663. Tomorrow is the last day for our Secret Santa discount, 20% off and free ship on orders of 25 or more. Have
Hi,
a great
Wendy.
Holiday.
You too. Have a good holiday. Merry Christmas to you. That's Wendy Wilson from thepowerherbs.com, 866-229-3663. I'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit csetalkradio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Merry Christmas to all of you. Happy holidays. There's an article from the AFP, and the headline is, India Rolls Back Latest Curbs on Deposits of Banned Notes. You may have heard about this. Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India unleashed chaos last month with his shock move to withdraw high-denomination rupee notes from circulation in an effort to tackle widespread corruption and tax evasion. That's their excuse. The people were engaged in activities that they were evading taxes is what it came down to. They were doing business by cash. The government needs the money, and therefore they want to get rid of the cash. So they got rid of 500 rupee notes and 1,000 rupee notes. And a 500 rupee note is worth about $7.50. And a 1,000 rupee note, of course, would be worth about $15. Well, these represented about 86% of all of the physical cash that was in the Indian economy. And the government declared that you had to turn them in, and you couldn't turn in more than 5,000 of these old banknotes. You had to turn them into the bank, and they would make a deposit into a digital bank account. From then on, you'd be essentially digital. All right, your savings. And the reason is because the Indian people were squirreling away these larger notes. Again, $7.50 and $15 notes. They were hiding. They were squirreling them away, hiding them in their mattress, hiding them wherever, and they weren't being taxed on them. They weren't in the banking system where they could be discovered by the government. And the government wanted it stopped, so they got rid of these bigger notes. Well, now after they've thought about it, and people have, India's central bank on Wednesday, they rolled back the order restricting deposits of banned rupee bills into bank accounts after the move sparked a huge public backlash. On Monday, just days before the December 30th deadline to swap old rupee notes for new ones, the Reserve Bank of India said that deposits over 5,000 rupee notes and old banknotes would only be allowed one time. So if you had, let's just suppose for the sake of argument, 5,000 rupees would be, what, $75. If you were an Indian who had squirreled away several thousand dollars worth of rupees, and you had hidden them someplace, stuck them in your attic, buried them in your basement, whatever, they would only allow you to deposit 5,000 rupees, which would turn into, what, $7, $75. That's the most you could deposit into the bank. And if you happen to have $100,000 worth of rupees, you could only get about deposit 75, and the remainder of your $100,000 in rupees might be lost. In theory, you may not be able to deposit it, might not be able to put it in the banking system. In addition to that, people would also be required to explain why they had not deposited the money earlier. Where'd you get that 5,000 rupees? How come you haven't already deposited it? The central bank of India reversed its decision on Wednesday. As I said, on review of above, we advise that provisions of the above circular do not apply. They didn't give a reason for backing it up, but the truth of the matter is they've had riots, they've had demonstrations, and India is trying to force the government of India is trying to force the people of India to give up their cash and go into something like an all-digital currency system in India. Opposition parties have attacked the move, with many Indians already facing a shortage of cash as ATM machines run dry and long queues materialize outside banks across the country as people try to get rid of their old notes, some 86% of the bills in circulation. India's Prime Minister Modi, however, has repeatedly defended the scheme, saying it will bring billions of so-called black or undeclared money back into the formal system. So we want you to be part of the government-sponsored economy. They don't want you to have a monetary mechanism that you can use other than the government-sanctioned digital currency. And I think what this illustrates is that people smart enough to be elected to public office, high public office, they also think they're smart enough to run a national economy. It's almost never true. All right. President Obama, what does he know about running an economy? Yes, he may have some advisors and whatever. But as a practical matter, what does he know? In fact, what does your congressman know? What's your senator know? The presumption that people in serious, in high political office are actually smart enough to run the economy is a presumption, and it's not proven by any means. Again, people smart enough to be elected, they think they're smart enough to run the national economy. It's almost never true. Central planners of the sort found in the former Soviet Union and of the sort found in Washington, D.C. They think they're smart enough to run a national economy. It's also, that's also almost never true. Free markets can be a mess. They're subject to a lot of volatility, but they effectively admit their errors and tend to be self-healing. If the free market does something stupid and the Dow Jones all of a sudden jumps to 40,000, right? It's entirely possible that a free market, which is not regulated, not controlled, it could go from 20,000 to 40,000. Some people would say yay, and some people would be ruined when it quickly dropped back, not just to 20,000, but maybe to 10,000. Free markets, nevertheless, tend to be self-healing. They go too far going up, they go too far going down, but they realize it, and then they make the correction, and they come back to what is perhaps a reasonable free market value. They can be a mess, but again, they admit their errors and tend to be self-healing. Central planners cause huge problems to build up because, one, the central planners are nowhere near as smart as they suppose, claim, or posture to be, and two, central planning is not self-healing but is problem-denying. And three, the central planner's predilection to run an economy is based on political rather than economic objectives. And that contributes to problems. It causes problems to grow and grow until the only possible outcome is catastrophe. There is a lot of erratic activity in a free market, or there certainly can be. But what the central planners try to do is convince everyone that everything is running smooth, it's all stable, maintain public confidence, assure everyone that there's no boogeyman, there's nothing to worry about, we got it all under control. And in order to do that, they do things that are stupid, that are crazy, that kick the can down the road. But in the process, the can grows. Every time you kick the can gets bigger. And you kick it down the road and you say, well, we've postponed the problem for the next Congress or the one after that, or our grandchildren, or our children. Maybe our children will have to deal with it, but we don't have to deal with it today. What they finally do in central planning, rather than admit, oh my gosh, we made a big mistake, they will double down and they'll try to manipulate the economy, control the economy, command the economy in ways that they think will not just make the economy stronger, but will prevent people from blaming the central planners for whatever we have. And the problems inevitably grow bigger and bigger and bigger. And the point to my argument, my observations here is somebody's got to sit back and let the economy run on the basis of a free market. Ultimately, the people of this country have a better idea of what to do with the economy than does the government. Yeah, we do stupid things, I agree. But we also correct. As soon as it's obvious that it's stupid, we correct. And some people will lose a fortune when we make that correction. But still, the free market tends to correct itself. It tends to be self-healing. The central planning, and Prime Minister Modi in India, is a good illustration. This guy doesn't know what he's doing. He has gone in over his head. He's tried to make something happen. Try to get rid of all the cash, replace it with a digital currency, debit cards, credit cards, whatever. That's what he's pushing for. And this whole thing has blown up in his face because he actually thinks just because he was elected, he thinks he can run the economy, and that's just not true. One of the things we see in a move that seems to be gathering momentum around the world, they're trying to get rid of cash. Governments around the world are trying to get rid of cash. We hear Larry Summers here in the United States, he's advocated, get rid of the $100 bill, the dreaded $100 bill, and they will justify this as it will inhibit drug dealing and the rest, that sort of thing. After inflation, today's $100 bill is worth about $5 as compared to what money was worth when I was a little boy. My grandfather used to walk around with $100 bills in his pocket. My dad had $100 bills in his pocket. They were not drug dealers, and the world was a better place. Our central planners have said, no, we got to get rid of these $100 bills to prevent drug dealing, as if that's going to work. It's not going to work, and what are we getting in return? We will not stop drugs. The war on drugs has been an abject failure. They're not going to stop drugs no matter what they do, in my opinion. I mean, unless they start shooting people, and even then I doubt that the drugs are going to be, you're going to keep the drugs out of the market. But removing the $100 bill is equivalent to removing $5 bills when I was a kid. After inflation, $100 bill now has the purchasing power of a $5 bill when I was a kid. If we had gone to my father, my grandfathers, and said, look, we're going to take these $5 bills out of circulation in order to prevent criminal activity, they would have been laughed out of, they would have been laughed out of Washington, D.C. We couldn't do that. They did get a lot of bigger bills. We had $1,000 bills and I think $5,000 bills back when I was a kid. They reduced it down to where now we have, you know, ones, fives, tens, twenties, fifties, hundreds. That's all we have left right now. But trying to get rid of the cash is not as easy as a lot of people suppose. People in government think, well, we'll just pass an executive order and we'll get rid of the cash. See, it's very simple. No, it's not that simple. I'll bet you a third of the transactions, and maybe more than that. I don't know what the number is. I don't recall. I knew, and I don't recall exactly, but it is a substantial proportion of all the transactions that take place in this country are still conducted in cash. There's a lot of people in this country that don't have bank accounts, couldn't get a credit card, couldn't get it, maybe couldn't even get a debit card. Of course, you can get a debit card if you've got cash to deposit or you've got an income to deposit, but a lot of people just don't have access to anything but cash, and if you were to destroy it, take it out of circulation, how do these people buy food? How do they pay their rent? It would cause some incredible public disturbance, chaos, to pull the cash out of this country. And we're seeing it. We're seeing it to some degree in Venezuela. We're seeing it to some degree in India. They're trying to get rid of certain parts of the cash, and all that's happening is people are rioting. They want their cash. Here in the United States, our government has been trying to get rid of the penny. I'll bet you for 20 years, maybe more than that. But public support for having the penny is so strong that they can't get the penny out of the monetary system. And they lose money on it. It costs more to make a penny than it is than the penny is worth. For all I know, it might cost a nickel to make a penny. No. But what's a nickel worth? I don't know. But we couldn't even get the penny out. And for those of you who may be concerned that our government is going to try to remove cash from circulation, You know, you look at the history, what's happened with the penny. You look what's happening in India. Look what's happening in Venezuela, and you can sit back and say, you know, I don't think this is going to be as easy as government, as some people would have you believe. I don't think they can get rid of cash completely. I don't think they can get rid of cash easily. I don't think they can get rid of $100 bills easily. I'm sure they'd like to. Yeah, but I don't think they can pull it off. We'll watch and see. But in the meantime, as they try to get rid of cash, what's happening? People are looking for alternatives. All right, take the dollar. Take the $100 bills. People are going into Bitcoin, for example. Some people are going into gold. Some people are going into silver in anticipation of using them. If push comes to shove, some people are going into Bitcoin, a private digital currency. What's the government going to do about private digital currencies? Can they make them illegal? In other words, if I wanted to buy, you have a bass boat and I've got to use pickup truck and I'd like to buy your bass boat, would it be illegal for me to swap my pickup truck for your bass boat? If we agreed, is that going to be an illegal transaction? Because in the end, if I can't transact on a private basis, I tell you what, I'll give you my pickup truck for your bass boat. What do you say? If I can't use a private currency like Bitcoin, or perhaps like gold and silver to buy your pickup truck, is bartering completely illegal? We're no longer able to trade anything. We must, every time we have a transaction and property moves from hand to hand, we have to include the government where the government gets its cut and have its protection money from any of the activity we involve ourselves in. The whole thing is strange. It's weird. It's evidence that the government is going broke. It's evidence that they are desperate for more money, and they'll try to get it any way they can. Or at least they're certainly tempted by any money they see. If they see it, they think they should be entitled to take it. And it's one of the reasons why you may have to be wary about where you bank and how much you keep in the bank. Because all of your currency now in the bank is digital. It can be vacuumed up by government anytime they want. Just tap into the bank accounts and whoo, whoo, whoo. Every one of those, your bank account, mine, everyone else's, can be frozen. They can be evacuated. They can take all of the currency, the digital currency, easily done. And governments are broke around the world. We are so deeply in debt. The national debt is so enormous that governments around the world are looking for something, anything. Where do we get some money that we can, where does government get some currency that they can use to offset their debts? And in their desperation, they're going to look to take anything they can lay their hands on, which, again, one of the reasons, you want to look at gold, you want to look at silver. You may have to hide it, but regardless, you still have it. And it'll continue to work just as it's worked for the past several thousand years. It'll work on into the future. I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival. I'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk here on Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Here's an article from the International Business Times, and the headline is, "Will Robots Steal Your Job?" Probably. There's our headline. Artificial intelligence-driven automation will be a crucial driver of economic growth in the United States, but if not handled properly, it can also lead to a massive disruption in the current livelihoods of millions of Americans and could, at least in the short term, even increase societal inequality. They're saying the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to get poorer. And they say it's going to be a crucial driver of economic growth. I'm not absolutely certain how they calculate economic growth, because if robots are going to cause economic growth, how are people who are replaced by robots, how are they going to have money to spend? I don't think it's true that robots are going to foster economic growth. I don't think the economy will grow bigger. It might happen, I don't know. But I'm inclined to think that if we have robots making things, but nobody to buy things, will the economy grow? Will we once again become the number one exporter in the world? Will our robots make products that will be sold? Can we produce products more cheaply with robots in this country than China can produce in China? And if so, will we replace China as the world's number one industrial exporter? And if we did, in theory, I suppose you could increase the economic growth in the United States, but my feeling is that if you're going to have more robots, you're going to have less people employed. In theory, they're going to have less money to spend. That does not look like evidence of economic growth to me. But the article continues. It says this recent report, follow-up to a recent one released by the White House in October, urges policymakers to be prepared to face a range of potential outcomes. Right? When they say a range of potential outcomes, what do you suppose they mean? They mean it could be fairly good, it might be real bad. They don't know what's going to happen here. And when they say a range of potential outcomes, they don't mean a range of potential good outcomes. They mean a range of outcomes that can range from, you know, very bad to perhaps pretty good. The reason they expect a range of potential outcomes is they say an accurate assessment of artificial intelligence impact on the economy is dauntingly hard to make. I wonder about that. Is it dauntingly hard to make, or is it dauntingly hard to admit? You know, it doesn't take a lot of... I know that this is a complex subject, and I know that I may be oversimplifying, and I may be mistaken, but still, if we're going to put a machine in, if we're going to get a robot to take your job, you can bet the only reason they're going to invest in that robot is because it's cheaper to run that robot than it is to pay you. All right? That's why the corporation will say, well, we're going to get this robot because we can get two robots in here, or three, for the price of one worker. And we can make more products, and we can sell them at a lower price, or we can increase our profit margin. We diminish our costs, and we become more competitive. it seems undeniable that more robots will also mean more unemployment for living men and women. And at least for the moment, when they say an accurate assessment of the impact of artificial intelligence on the economy is dauntingly hard to make, I'm not convinced that's true. It might be dauntingly hard to specify and say that we will have exactly this many jobs lost or exactly this much money will be lost to the economy. Maybe we can't make a precise assessment of the artificial intelligence impact, but we can make a general assessment. It's got to increase unemployment. And how that's going to stimulate the economy is not easily understood. The article goes on. It says it's not impossible that artificial intelligence will not have large new effects on the economy, such that the coming years are subject to the same basic workforce trend seen in recent decades, some of which are positive and others which are worrisome and may require policy changes. And this is from the White House. Because of the effects of artificial intelligence-driven automation will be felt across the whole economy, and the areas of greatest impact may be difficult to predict, policy responses must be targeted to the whole economy. Now, that bothers me. When they talk about policy responses targeted to the whole economy, what are they talking about? They're talking about more central planning. I said, we're going to come up with general rules for the whole economy. We're going to run everything from Alaska to the Key West. All right, everything in between, Hawaii to Maine. We're going to run it all on to run the whole economy. And I'm inclined to believe, as I talked earlier in the program, I don't think central planning works. I don't think it works anywhere on the face of the earth. I don't think it's ever worked, although it's been able to hold on for a couple of generations in the former Soviet Union before central planning ultimately collapsed the Soviet Union. And I think central planning will collapse the economy of the United States of America. I think the idea that the whole economy can be controlled by one really smart guy or a handful of really smart guys in Washington, D.C., I think that's absurd. I think it's ridiculous. Inevitably, you will have people up there who are in it for themselves, in it for their cronies. They will make certain adjustments and say, what the heck, I got a good buddy who's running a steel mill over, you know, across the road over here. Let's do something in law to help my friend. It's not economics, it's politics. And when you give people the power to control the economic system, you inevitably give them the power to exploit the economic system. And you can bet, it's a virtual certainty, that they will exploit the economic system. And the only way you can stop it, it is human nature to take advantage of the kinds of power when you're able to control the whole economy, at least not every detail, but you have predominant control, you have significant control over the whole economy. I guarantee you it opens the door to graft, corruption, abuse, stupidity. I look at this and I'm thinking, these robots are a terrible thing to waste. Rahm Emanuel and Hillary Clinton were famous for making the comments a couple of years ago that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. They don't see a crisis as something to be solved. They see a crisis as something to be exploited. When people are all hysterical and they're all excited, then you jump in and you do what you want done for your special and for the benefit of your special interests, your personal interests, to increase your power. They see a crisis as something to be exploited rather than something to be corrected. And I think this robot situation will be that kind of crisis. And there will be plenty of politicians that will try to take advantage of it. And they'll say, oh my gosh, we've got to do something about the robots. And maybe we do, maybe we don't. But the probability that the politicians will not try to exploit this blooming crisis, not high. Virtual certainty. They'll do what they can to use the crisis to gain political power, personal wealth, whatever, and use the crisis as an excuse for gaining power or wealth. The article continues, it says estimates of how many jobs would be lost to artificial intelligence over the coming decades very widely, largely because the technology is still in its fledgling state and its disruptive effects on jobs markets are still a few years, if not a few decades, from being widely felt. I mean, the idea that this is going to be several decades before we get into, before we really feel the effect of robots, I don't think that's correct at all. I think we will see significant impact from robot technology in the next just couple of years if we're not seeing it already. The article continues. It says, as a result of the predictions range from a staggering 47% of U.S. jobs being at risk from the advent of artificial intelligence and increase in computerization to a more conservative estimate of about 6%. Well, you can bet 6% of the jobs are going to disappear, right? But could 47% of our jobs disappear? Could they be? Could we? Could 47% of the people in this country have jobs be replaced by robots? And I don't doubt that the technology is going to be available where that's entirely possible, and maybe much more than that. I don't believe for a minute that only 6% are going to lose their jobs to robots. 47% though, can you imagine that? Half the people in the country don't have jobs because they've been replaced by robots. Then what? It's going to make for an extraordinary change in our society. What do you do when half the people can't have jobs? Not just don't have jobs, can't have jobs because the robots are cheaper. And if the robots are cheaper, the only reason to install the robot is not because they're cute or they don't take cigarette breaks, you know, twice a shift. That's not the reason. The reason is because they're cheaper. If you've got one guy's working, he's got a job and he's making $50,000 a year, replace him with a robot and the robot only costs $20,000 a year. That means there's a $30,000 that is not going to an employee. It might be going to corporate profits, but more than likely it's just a matter, it's cutting costs, probably. Now, how do we get into a world where we are cutting costs by, say, 40, 50, 60%, and still the economy is going to grow? If the numbers, the hypothetical numbers that I'm fooling with, and that's all I'm doing, they're just hypothetical. I don't know that they're anywhere close to reality, but we're replacing a man who has a $50,000 a year job with a $20,000 a year robot. Okay, the robot's taking in $20,000 a year. We're not going to take the money that's required. Keep the guy, he used to make $50,000. What's he going to make once he's replaced by the robot? Yes, we can tax the robots, but it can't be as much. It can't be as much as we were formerly paying for this living employee. We're not going to take a robot that costs $20,000 a year to operate and tax it another $30,000 to give to the guy who used to have a job that the robots replaced. We're going to maybe tax the robot $5,000. There just is no obvious way that I'm able to understand that these robots are going to create more money, and we're going to have more money to be divided by the populace of this country. In the end, the robots, for now, it appears logical, at least, and maybe irrefutable, they're going to reduce the amount of money that's being generated by production of products. And when there's less money produced, where's the money going to come from to keep the guy? He used to make $50,000 a year. Now he's going to make what? On some sort of glorified Social Security. What? $20,000? $10,000? $15,000? How's he going to raise a family? How's he going to raise a family on that? Used to make $50,000, now he makes $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 as some sort of a government subsidy that they've a tax imposed on robots, and it goes to people that are now unemployed. This is going to be a problem, and they're fooling around here. They say it'll be maybe in a few years, maybe a few decades. I don't believe for a minute we're talking a few decades. This is going to happen, and it's going to happen fairly fast. Research consistently finds that the jobs that are threatened by automation are highly concentrated among lower paid, lower skilled, and less educated workers. This means that automation will continue to put downward pressure on demand for this group, putting downward pressure on wages and upward pressure on inequality. If you're in the top 1%, top 10%, robots won't hurt you. They may help you. If you're in the bottom 20, 30%, you're in trouble, maybe even 50%. What are we going to do with these people? How are they going to be fed? I don't doubt that can be done, but this will not be. If you're going to feed them enough where they can have a reasonable life, there'll be a lot of people say, sign me up too. No reason why I should work. I'll just get a robot. I quit. Hire a robot to replace me as long as I... If you don't give them enough to have a decent life, they're going to riot. What are we going to do with these people? We live in interesting times, ladies and gentlemen, and the solutions, the problems are apparent if you care to look for them. The solutions are a lot less obvious, but some kind of solutions, and almost certainly painful solutions, will have to take place. Something's got to be done, and it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be fun. We are headed for that kind of a world. We're already in that world to some degree, and we're going to get more of it as we go further into the future. And one of the things, again, you know, you can guess what I'm going to say next. And if you want to protect yourself against what may be difficult times ahead, one of the things you'll want to do is get some gold, get some silver. If you agree, give Melody a call. It's 1-800-375-4188. Discount gold and silver. I'm Alfred Adisk. We'll be back tomorrow. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Todd, the producer.
Bye-bye.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.